Welcome to the Brothers Murph Get Smart, a weekly podcast in which two brothers, namely myself, Michael E. Murphy,
and myself, Nick Murphy,
attempt to become more knowledgeable about this big blue world that we live on and all the things in it. Did that for you, Nick.
Thank you.
And joined with us this week is the incomparable
Casey Brown.
And this week we're going to be talking about visual effects and everything that goes into it. This is a huge, obviously, subject, but it's something that we see in movies a lot. There's all sorts of CGI and crazy stuff and, you know,
video
Star
games
Wars and video games. There's just all sorts of like computer people.
Particularly, I think it's cool because there's a lot of like visual effects that like you don't know that are there.
That's what I'm interested
in. There's like the, you know, the explosion or that like character is CGI and stuff. But you might not know that like, this really basic tree over here is also not there. I think that's cool.
It's like a tiny little crab just scurrying about. That thing ain't real. So that's what we want to talk about, is everything that goes into visual effects and CGI and stuff.
The most interesting
how do we
was
make movies.
Whenever Mike is in movies, they have to CGI a soul.
Yeah.
Which is nice, you know. Yeah. So
because I have the dead eyes thing in real life, so they have to like make it alive in there, or else people get very upset. Yeah. So we brought our expert for today, someone who works in this field. He's worked all over, is our man, Aaron Coleman Hayes, right here.
ACH.
He is an artist extraordinaire. Okay. He worked on visual effects houses. He's worked on pre-production houses and for film. He's worked in video games, everything CGI. This dude has worked on it. So I think you're the perfect person to kind of school us up on like, how do you make things that aren't real.
I will do my best, but make no promises.
Yes.
That's
we appreciate
fair.
That.
That's very fair.
Thank you for having
so,
me.
So, can I start with the dumbest question?
Always.
What are visual effects? What is that?
It's a real broad.
Always take us down to the bare bottom.
I don't know. I watch movies, and I'm just like, I go in, guys, as a preface, I just love every movie. I'm not a critic. I don't walk out of movies and be like, that was terrible because of this and this. I'm like, Batman vs. Superman, I liked it. So I'm not a good judge of this stuff.
Is there any CGI in that movie? I think that's all practical, right?
So I don't know like what's visual effects, what's a real effect. I don't know, like, you know, I know that there are actors, but that's as far as my knowledge goes. So what is it? Aaron?
I mean, that's a
tell us.
It's a really broad question. I mean, it encompasses a lot of different aspects of a movie. And so your visual effects range from anywhere from just like creating an environment in CG and having it in the background of a shot or a scene, or animating characters or objects doing certain things that, you know, would normally take too long to build practically. And I mean, visual effects are going to be in pretty much every movie. It can even be something as small as like color correcting a background or throwing a matte painting. Like if you're like, say you're directing a movie like The Revenant, right? And you have this really nice shot, but it would look even better if there was like a mountain in the back. You can go in post-production and take a mountain literally and do what's called like matte painting and just throw it in there. And it's there, and that's
tight.
Considered visual.
So
effects.
We could like film in our studio here and then just have there be like a forest all around us if we had enough money.
You would have to completely cover the studio in blue or
okay,
green.
I didn't
screen.
Like the air quotes. Okay. Our bedroom is a very classy and professional studio. But thank you for that.
Technically, yes.
Okay. But, okay. Yeah. That makes sense. I understand more, guys, where we're starting from here. So we've got VFX. How does one even get involved in this world? Like, how did you like look at a movie and say, I want to do that?
I mean, it's different for everybody, but for me, I really love movies, and I originally got into working in this kind of industry because I love video games more than I love movies. So I went to
suck at movies.
Yeah. But it's funny, like that's what I got into this industry to do, but I've worked more in movies than I have in video games. And so I went to Cal State Northridge for a year because I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I just knew I wanted to do some sort of art. I really liked to draw in school and doodle on my paper and whatnot for my homework and turn it in. didn't really like what I was getting at CSUN. I didn't like the teachers.
CSUN's a great school, but not known for its art program.
Like,
that's where Costco
we call it CSUN, by the way. Anyone who's not from Northridge. Yeah. So damn. Now you're in the know.
Now you can be a cool kid and be like, yeah, man, I go to CSUN. And they're like, yeah. Okay.
Like, obviously that guy's from here. He knows what CSUN is. But it just like it just wasn't like the direction I wanted to take my art, and so I went to without really too much thought, I went to the Art Institute of California in North Hollywood. Not the best school for this kind of stuff.
Okay, despite its name.
Despite right. its name,
Art Institute really good for geology. Weird.
they did say the Art Institute of North Hollywood, not Los Angeles or anything. It's just true. Like, well, this one like little part, like we do art. Was it more about the teachers or was it the curriculum that you're like, no, this isn't the kind of art I want to do? Like, I guess how'd you get to doing the art that you actually like?
Well, so I graduated from the Art Institute and I have a degree in game design, game art and design. And what I wanted to do was, for the longest time, I wanted to do just concept art paintings. So when it comes to a movie or when it comes to a video game and you're fleshing out the idea for whatever you want to do, whether it's a character, whether it's an environment, or just like an aspect of the story, you have an artist sit down and normally they'll draw it out or they'll paint it out just to like kind of get a visual of it. And that's what I wanted to do. And with about a year left in my, term of the Art Institute, that was still what I wanted to do, but my painting skills weren't really that great. And so I went to this 2-day workshop. It was 10 artists over 2 days, we got 5 each day, and they all just came and talked about their art that they did in the movie industry, and it was all, you know, professionals and whatnot, at this school called the Noman Visual Effects School. And if I could redo everything I did, I would be going there for sure. It's a great, like, great school. I have no affiliation with it, but I'm plugging it anyway.
Yeah. Shout out to Noman. We'll tweet at you.
Yeah.
They're a great school. All our students have just amazing work. But so they brought all these artists in, and 3 of the artists that were up there was Neville Page, Dominic Queck, and Raphael Grissetti, who are all incredibly talented, top of the line. Just everybody knows their name in the art community. And they were showing the characters and creatures that they had done for movies. And it was all 3D, and it was all done really quickly, and it was in a conceptual format, which is what I wanted to do, essentially. But I had never seen it done like that before, and I figured, wow, I didn't know that that was possible. And so the program that they use mostly is this program called ZBrush. And I had opened ZBrush like maybe once or twice when I was at school. I didn't really have anybody teach me how to use it, but they were doing things in ZBrush that I had never seen before. And they showed us these demos and stuff. And I was just blown away. And I was like, that's what I want to do. 100%. Like, it was just it was the coolest thing.
Damn.
It was awesome. And so they weren't really teaching ZBrush or creature concepts or a creature conceptual class or design course at AI. It was all just like standard curriculum for games. And so I finished and got my degree, but the last year that I was there, I practically had to teach myself a lot. Wow. I did have one teacher who came in for like 2 quarters. His name is Cordell Felix. He's an awesome artist in the game industry.
What a name. Cordell Felix.
So cool.
Hey, man, I'm Cordell Felix. Y'all want to draw Cthulhu?
he's a great artist, and he taught me the basics of ZBrush in class. And from there, I found tutorials online that some of my other teachers directed me towards, and I just essentially took those tutorials that I found, and I didn't really copy them, you know, per se, but I made creatures that were very similar to the ones in the tutorials, and I learned a ton from tutorials. Other artists like Kurt Papstein and Dominic Queck were really helpful.
So you just kind of used a self-starter, man.
For the most part, yeah.
Wow. Would you say that's your specialty, is like creature stuff? Like, absolutely. That's what you do?
Yeah. Right. Like, on my website, everything I have is pretty much creature related. All right, cool. I don't really have too many realistic humans up there.
And that's cool, because like, I do art too. Like, the logo for the Brothers Murphy Get Smart, like, I did my brother and I, and so we've talked about this before. It's cool because we're both artists, but like what you do is like something that I so hardcore cannot do. Just like, doing, cause I mostly do a lot of portraitures and stuff like that. And I change them in interesting ways, but like, I just, everything I do is based in some kind of like realism and stuff like that. And it's just, I love talking to artists like you because I'm just like, what is your mind? Cause my mind can't even fathom like, oh, I'm going to make this creature, but he's got a really big head, but you know, a small body, but then really big feet. And I can't,
what if his bones were on the outside?
Yeah, exactly. like what? I'm going to make this organ. So I love talking to you about that. Cause it's just so the absolute opposite of what I do. And I always like that. I think it's cool.
It's bitching.
And it's interesting too, cause you would think it would be completely the opposite too, but in order to like make a creature that's believable for any sort of realistic anything, like there has to be a basis of anatomy understanding.
Yeah, yeah,
sure. So like if I'm making a face of an alien or something, he needs to have a specific bone structure. His bones need to move a certain way. His muscles need to move a certain way. And that all comes down from the foundations that you learn, like what you're doing, you know, with your drawings and stuff. Like that translates so well and so much more than you think to anything creative, like creatures or monsters or anything. It all bleeds in together, even with, you know, animal anatomy. Like, if you're doing something as far as like making a face a little saggier or just like putting extra folds of skin somewhere, like they have to be there for a reason. You can't just throw them on there because they look cool. Like if the body moves a certain way, maybe the folds aren't there and you have to take that into consideration when you're like doing all this stuff. So it definitely
adding that realism to something so fantastic.
Portraits.
Yeah.
That's cool.
It's just straightforward. That's what I do.
So, I mean, you know, you kind of touched on the idea is you want to make something that's a creature, something that's out of this world, but you want to have it be realistic to itself and everything. So is that the main goal in movies and everything? I mean, now with movies, we have people trying to create every kind of alien and, you know, before seen creature, but then we also have people trying to recreate people and making things look very realistic. And I guess, you know, maybe can you talk about your experience with working at VFX studios and what's that like and what all goes into like making, you know, I guess there's shots of all kinds and everything. Just tell us about
that. That was like six questions.
I know. As soon as I start going, I'm like,
okay,
this thing.
My question is, so there's these visual
effects. That's why Casey usually asks the questions because she makes them concise and nice.
So, okay, but no, I mean, that's all what we want to know, but like...
I just want to know so much things.
Is in the... So you got all this schooling and learning, and you go to this a VFX studio, and you say, okay, now I can go work on visual effects in movies.
Right.
Is that VFX studio, is that like a movie studio that we know, or are there like a bunch of them that all work on one movie? Or, you know, I don't understand, because it's like, to me, I'm like, that's a Disney movie, but are there like 100 different studios that are all contributing to that Disney movie and none of us know the names of those studios?
When it comes to visual effects, there's hundreds of visual effects houses. For as far as Disney and Pixar goes, I don't know how much of their stuff they outsource. I think they keep it pretty much in-house. They do a bunch of hirings, like, you know, 500 people for a project. But one of the movies I worked on was Ant-Man. And so if you look at the credits for Ant-Man, you have, you know, after, you know, the main actors and the crew and everything for the production side, you go to post-production and you have Marvel Studios and they list all their artists. And then underneath there's like 7 or 8 different studios. So when I worked on Ant-Man, I was at this place, this visual effects house called Luma Pictures. And so we got, I think when we were there, I think we had over 400 shots for the movie. So a shot can be anywhere from like 2 to 20 seconds. And those were all ours. So we had to create some of the models for it or the animations or compositing and lighting and all this stuff. And so certain studios will just get different shots. I'm not entirely sure how the shots are given out. I assume some studios have to bid for them. But there are a ton of big studios like, Double Negative, Blur Studios. Blur is really insane. If you look at what's called a demo reel, they show you all of their like best work of the year. They have some amazing stuff. There's ILM is a big one, Industrial Light and Magic.
Sure,
they do a lot of stuff for, Star Wars. There's just, There are so many visual effects houses, and I know I've only named like four, but I'm just there's a ton.
Are these visual effects houses? Do they tend to have like a specialty? Like Luma, we're good at making bananas, and then like we're good at making trees. Like are they kind of like, does a house like, do they hire like a bunch of different people to like really have it well rounded, or is it like this studio, you hire us because we're bomb at lighting jungle scenes, you know, or something? Is it kind of a mix?
It's I would say for the most part it's kind of a mix, but there are studios that specialize or have done really good work in certain fields. Like Luma, when I got there, it was really well known for its creature work. They created the creature for the city of Ember, I think, was a movie a little while ago. It was like this vole with all this fur, and it was huge and it was giant. They did that. They created I can't remember if it was Thor the Dark World. I think they created two creatures in there. There was this big rock golem at the beginning that they had to,
that's cool.
I think they actually had to design a new pipeline as far as working on that guy, because he's made of all these individual rocks that have to move, you know, when he does and explode when he does. And so they had to create this whole different way of working on that just for that guy. They did one of the I can't remember what he was called, but it was this big, like four-legged creature that they find in the ice world.
Cool.
So that was like their thing. But Luma, when I was working there, I didn't work on any creatures. So Luma also has the artists and the capabilities to work on whatever is thrown at them. And that's kind of the way you survive in a visual effects environment, is being, not having a specific specialty. So because your income at that point is just based on how much work you're getting. And if there's no creature work going around, like if that's like a lull in the movie industry, then you're just because like kind of cutting yourself short.
It's all contractual, right? It's all like, you have this contract, and is that generally for the artists as well as the studio itself? Or like, do they have like full time, like you work for Lumos and you're like the general employee, or is it independent contractors? Or
I would say, in my experience at least, for the most part, I would say about maybe 75%, maybe a little less, of the studio is made up by what are called freelancers or contractors. Uh-huh. So obviously there are people there that are full-time employees, you know, like upper management and stuff. But I was hired on contract to work at Luma for, you know, however long. And sometimes it'll be just for an extended period of time, or it'll be for a specific project. That I know for video games, it's basically project-based, because a studio will put out one game and you're there for that game. Yeah. And then when the game's over, like, then you're out. And I know some visual effects studios do that if they get, if they're getting a ton of work for like one movie, they'll just hire a bunch of people to work on that one movie. And that's how long their contract is for, is until that movie is done.
Okay.
So how many people, I'm sure it varies but size by size from the studios, but like, how many people work at these VFX studios? Obviously, when they have a project. When they don't have a project, it's like, I'm sure, bare bones staff. But
right,
you know, when they have a project, are you like one of dozens or hundreds or?
It depends. Obviously, it depends and it varies. It depends on how successful the studio is, and it also depends on how many projects they have running at the same time. So when I was in visual effects, we were working at like four or five movies at the same time. So maybe there's a shot that's due this week for this movie, and that's what you're working on. And then next week, we need this done for this other movie, and that's what you get put on. Mm-hmm. And so when I was at Luma, there were probably 80 people at the LA studio, and I would guess close to the same at their sister studio in Melbourne. So
Australia?
Yeah. So a lot of these studios actually have different locations throughout the world. Like there's the studio called Method Studios. They have a location in Santa Monica. They have a couple in Canada. There's like they're just spreading themselves out. I mean, you want to get
artists are talented in different places. Pool.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, it's smart too. If you're a studio and you have deadlines, if you've got people in different time zones working on stuff, that's smart. If someone's sleeping, okay, night shift, come in, Melbourne.
Sure. Yeah.
Sure.
Daytime for you.
That was essentially, from what I heard, that was essentially the plan when Luma made their studio in Melbourne. It was one, because of the time zone thing. When we were on lunch, or when we were like kind of Yeah, when we were on lunch, people were like just starting to come in to the Melbourne studio, and it would be like the next day. It wouldn't be like, you know, hard day. I think they're like 16 hours ahead or something.
And this, if anyone's wondering why movies cost so much money, it's because
the manpower.
It's like for like Ant-Man or something like that, it's like you were one of like probably like 10 studios on this. And there is, like you said, like 80 people at your studio, probably 80 in Melbourne.
And it's that's like one studio.
And that's one studio. And it's like there might be 20 people working on one shot that's like 15 seconds long for like a month. And you're like, how does this cost $200 million? That's why. And that's not including they're paying the actors, they're paying the directors, producers, writers, guys to bring coffee to all those people, you know, gaffers and lighters. It's like, if you ever been
fluffers,
we've been lucky enough because Mike's an actor, so he's been on set and stuff. But our roommate is a director and I've been on his sets and stuff like that. And you just see like all the working parts and like all the different cogs of the machine. And you're just like, oh, this is why this costs so much.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
oh, my gosh.
This is insane.
I grew up here in L.A. in Hollywood, and my dad worked on the TV show Frasier for the entirety of its run. And so we would get to go, and as a kid, I was convinced that they spent like $1 million on craft services.
Yeah.
Because there was so much food everywhere. I was just, we would get to go on set, and everybody would be handing me like full-size candy bars and like, just, I was like, this must cost them so much money, just the food.
Yeah.
It's true. And that's why it costs. It's
not $1 million, but it's close to, guys.
So question. So you were saying, or Nick said, oh, there might be 20 people working on a shot. So I'm curious, if you have like one shot, it's not just one person drawing everything, right? I'm assuming there's all these different things go on and you have to light it. Like what will go into a shot, and were you working on all the aspects of it, or did you do one, you know, layer or one step of this shot?
What's a shot?
Can you break that down a little bit about
Alexander Hamilton throw his away?
Hamilton
in that movie about CG Hamilton. That's what that play about.
It's a good show.
I can totally take you through what it takes for one shot. So a shot can be anywhere from like 2 to, like I said, like 20 seconds and probably even longer. So a shot would be like if you're ever watching a movie and you're watching some action happen on the screen and then it jump cuts to something else.
Yeah.
So that before the jump cut, that was one shot.
Sure.
So like in Ant-Man, there's this scene where he's in this computer server area and he's going through and like kind of blowing stuff up. So that's an entire scene, but there's multiple shots in that entire scene.
Yeah, right. Hundreds. Yeah.
Yeah. So essentially, for a shot, and so when I was working on these shots, I was doing modeling and texturing. So I was creating 3D models and texturing them for the shot. I was making assets, essentially. So if there was an environment or a background or like a computer server that, you know, we're not going to film that because we got to have these magical ants running all over them with these little backpacks and stuff, like you're not going to film that. You need to model it. So on the computer, you know, using programs like Maya and ZBrush, I would create whatever it is they needed me to create. So if they needed a motherboard for a PC, like me and my buddy Rusty Courier actually did, there's this scene in Ant-Man where a bunch of the ants with these little backpacks get on this motherboard and they all like kind of electrocute it. And so Rusty and I had to go through the entire process of modeling and some texturing for that motherboard. So we created all the assets and we built it and everything. And it was supposed to take like two
asset. When you say that, what does that mean?
So like on a motherboard or like in here in our studio here, say we were filming something in here and we needed those headphones to be 3D or computer generated, the headphones would be considered an asset.
Okay. So almost like a prop?
Yeah, pretty much. It's kind of a loose term that you throw around, like a character could be an asset too.
Okay.
Things so that kinda fill up the scene and
pretty much, yeah.
The shot, I should say.
Yeah. So that shot was supposed to take, or that scene that we were building was supposed to take like I think we were given like a week and a half or 2 weeks.
We did it in 4 days.
What?
Bam!
Those were awesome.
And then you sat back and got paid.
He said, I'm Eric Coleman. Hey.
Did they like, oh, good job? Or there's like, okay, here's another shot. Go do that now. You're like, all right.
They said, good job. Here's another shot.
Yeah. Sure. Cool.
Is it, backing up bigger picture, is this something that like Marvel came to Luma and said, this is what we want this to look like exactly? Or did Luma have some say in the actual like design and look of the little computer screen and the ants and stuff, or was Marvel like, no, this?
So when I talk you through the shot, that comes into play.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
And most of those decisions are made by people higher than me. So I'm not entirely sure what the communication process was on that. But so, say for example, we were creating that server room shot, or where they're on the motherboard. So you have some sort of concept artist maybe like blocking it out at Marvel, saying, hey, this is kind of what we want it to look like, but we're going to give you some artistic freedom or whatever.
Like a storyboard?
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's that. And then essentially you have what are called pre-visualization artists take that storyboard and basically block it out in 3D so that they can give that to studios. So studios can use that 3D blockout scene as like, a guide of where to place things or how to animate certain things or how the shot is supposed to go. And so we'll build off of that. And then, so after previs, it gets sent, which is done actually by completely a different studio. We don't do any previs.
Oh, wow.
From where I've
heard. Oh, wow.
So there's a, I think it's called the Third Floor Previs Studio, and they do, most of their work is just pre-visualization. So they'll get all these shots, and I can't really talk on previs because I haven't worked in that department. But
sounds pretty technical.
For the most part, yeah.
Yeah.
So they're getting like a very rough,
incredibly rough.
Just, and will that have like camera movement and stuff? So yes. You know what's okay. So exactly. You're like, okay, the shot's going to go like this, and we're mm-hmm. going to end up over here, and there's going to be sort of these things, and then you guys get to play with it.
It's essentially a digital storyboard. So you have like the storyboard artist, okay. But then previs is like, you know, like if you have somebody driving a car or something, you know, you're not going to have all the animations of them moving the wheel up and down. You might have like, you know, a couple keyframes of them just so that you get the idea that they're driving. And so then we get that previs shot. And we're told like, hey, this needs to be, you know, a motherboard. These are certain assets in certain places. So then we'll go through, we'll model that in on the program, and then we'll texture it, and then that gets handed off to, you know, like a lighter who will light the scene, roto and paint artists, like rotoscoping and paint artists.
What is that?
Essentially, like, if say you have an actor that's got a bunch of wires on them and they're jumping up and down, like, you know, for a stunt, a roto and paint artist will paint that out so you don't see the wire.
Oh,
okay.
Cool. And they do other stuff too. Like, they'll take the assets that we make and kind of throw them into the scene a little bit and, make sure that it looks pretty seamless. And then after that, it's maybe taken back to a lighter to relight the scene, make sure everything looks cool. And then all that stuff gets given to a compositor, who will take all the different, will take all the different aspects, all the models, the textures, the scene, whatnot, and they'll put it together and throw different effects on them to achieve whatever the art director wants. And then that's the finished shot. So
wow.
So this goes through like
multiple channels,
six departments.
Yeah,
again,
and this is a 20-second top shot that goes through like six departments before it gets sent back to Marvel for them to say like yay or nay.
Correct.
Holy cow.
This is why movies cost so much money.
So, can I go back up just one quick question before we go forward? When you say texture,
mm-hmm.
is that like making something fuzzy, or is that like, what does that mean? Because I'm just thinking like, that means you make it velvet. And I'm sure that's not right.
Well, okay, so let's take, for example, like I'm looking around the studio here.
When's craft services get here, by the way?
Confused. Yeah, crafty on the way, guys?
Thought we had a good craft budget.
So take, for example, the drill that we have on this table over here, right? Mm-hmm. This Black & Decker.
Important for the studio, yeah, this drill.
Yeah, be the next shot. Yeah.
So you would model that out in 3D. So you're modeling out all the grooves, the little almost checkerboard holes in the back. You're going to put that in there too, the grooves at the top near the head. And essentially that's just going to be blank. It's just going to be gray.
Okay.
Right.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So it needs color. So texturing is essentially coloring in your model to make it, you know, orange and black and silver and everything. And then what also gets put onto there is actually this whole other area of visual effects called look development. So you can throw flat colors on there, but you're not going to be able to tell, oh, that's metal. Oh, that's rubber. You know, like you can see the color, but you can't see the material. Shading is exactly what it's called. So you have material artists who will look dev, you know, certain materials and try and get it right. And that's the shader that you throw onto the material with all the textures attached to it so that when you throw it into the 3D software and you're compositing it, the light that hits it reacts a certain way, like it would on rubber or on metal. And that's how you can, you know,
wow,
guess, you know, so, like that's metal or rubber.
Damn.
Like, and I'm sure this again varies depending on what, like the art direction, what they want to the look to look like. But so like when you're going in, is your goal to make something look like as good as humanly possible? Like, are you trying to like get it to look like perfect, you know, or is like, I'm trying to think of how to say it. Like, is your goal to make things look as realistic as possible?
As a contractually obligated artist, my goal is to make it look like whatever the art director wants it to look like. So, depending on the movie, you know, you want it to look as realistic as possible because the whole, so when you're in visual effects, you know, you've done an amazing job if nobody notices what you've done.
Exactly.
So like you want
the unsung heroes.
Yeah. Like you want everything to be as seamless as possible. You don't want somebody watching the movie to be like, oh man, that's not real. You know, like that's the worst possible reaction.
That's what I was trying to ask. I didn't.
Yeah. So you want it to look as realistic as possible as far as what the art director wants. Because the goal is to not pull the audience out of the movie. Because when you go to a movie, you're there for an experience or an escape. You don't want to get pulled back out. You know, you want to be ingrained.
And there is times where it's like, you can't, it can just kind of pull you away from a movie because something doesn't look good, you know, and it's just, it's tough that way where it's like, if they kind of skimp on the CGI budget, you're kind of like, okay, yeah, that's a movie.
Yeah,
there's this
whole thing in CG called, it's called the Uncanny Valley. And essentially, what that means is there's this idea that if you try to make something look too realistic, like say human faces, like in their, when they talk, like their animation when they talk, if something is even a little bit off, you're going to notice it as an audience and it's going to throw you off.
Right.
Because I mean, like say I'm modeling something like a human face and my eye shapes are wrong or my nose is wrong. Even somebody who's not artistically inclined or has a background in that, because they see faces every day, they're immediately going to know something's off. So there's this whole, it's called the Uncanny Valley. And we're getting like super close to being able to like kind of cross over it. But there are definitely still things that, if you're looking for them, that you can notice from something that's fully CG.
Well, one thing that always stands out to me, and I don't know if this falls in the same, the Uncanny Valley, but there was like the period where all those motion capture movies that Robert Zemeckis was making, like Polar Express and all those movies,
Beowulf,
that it was like really cool and realistic, except you'd look at the character's eyes and you're like, there's no soul there. You know, like everything was so realistic, but there was like, it took you out of the movie because you're watching this thing where they're trying to be so close to real, but they couldn't quite do that.
Yeah.
And then you look at something like a different motion capture, like Gollum in Lord of the Rings, which is totally not human realistic looking, but yet was so much more full of life.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And so I don't know if that relates to that, but I always notice that. And I think they're getting very, again, like you're saying, they're really getting good at it because you look at like a movie from, you know, 2003 or something where they were trying to do the motion capture and then now. And I think they're so close to getting to where you're like, oh, that is could be a real human. I don't know.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. We're at that point where it's like, it's so close, but there's just like minor things. Like when you said Beowulf, like the spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't seen Star Wars Rogue One.
Okay.
So
it's 2017. You guys should have done it.
there's two full CG characters in the movie. There's General Tarkin, and then Princess Leia at the end. And so,
R.I.P.
to both.
Yeah. Oh, I know. That's right.
Sorry.
I
miss you so much.
Spoiler alert: if you guys didn't know, Carrie Fisher is no longer with us.
It's 2017.
Okay, so we have two characters.
So they are completely CG from top to bottom. When you look at them and they're not moving, like just so you're essentially at that point, you're only looking at the modeling and the texturing aspect of it, and the lighting of the scene and the materials on the character and whatever. They look amazing. They look so great. And then they start moving around and they start talking. And it just completely breaks the mold. And so when that movie came out, we back at the studio where I'm working right now, we had a talk about it, because it seems like anybody who doesn't have a CG background did not notice, and then some, or like couldn't pinpoint what was going on, and then everybody that does have a CG background and was looking for something like that could instantly pinpoint it and say, damn, like they're so close. But yeah.
Funny that you say that, because when Mike and I saw the movie, Mike walked out and he was like, man, that was so cool with the general, what's his name?
Tarkin.
But every time he started talking, it kind of took me out of the movie, because I thought, wow, that's so cool.
And I was having the same thing in my head. I was like, damn, that's really close.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize. Like, I walked out and I was like, that's so awesome. And I didn't know that actor had been dead for like 15 years.
Which is impressive. 20 years. It's interesting. And he said, I guess because there's so many, no person's alike. Like the way we talk, the way we shape our words, everything's a little bit different. And so it's really hard to replicate. Yeah. Like I go back and watch Men in Black, the first one. I have no problems with the CGI in that movie because they're all goofy aliens. They're not trying to look realistic, so trying to do humans is the hardest thing. But
yeah, when you watch a movie that's from years ago that tried to do like realistic CGI,
it's
terrible. But like, we just watched The Mask, and that shit holds up.
Oh yeah,
because it's cartoony. It's like cartoons, and it looks great because they're not trying to be like so real.
But I will say, you're right, it's when the talking is when it kind of fell apart. But right at the very end, when Princess Leia first turns and you see her face, that floored me. I was like, holy crap, that looks so real. And then she talked, I was like, and I'm back out. And so you're you know.
And the problem with that is so for video games and movies, whenever you have anybody who's CG, so essentially every video game ever, you have
what?
You have
those weren't just documentaries that you could control.
You have the actors that are playing those CG characters are usually doing motion capture. So when you first hear motion capture, you think of like maybe Gollum in the Lord of the Rings. You know, Andy Serkis playing him, and all the apes for Planet of the Apes, which I still haven't seen yet. I really need to see.
It's good. It's good. So good. The third one's about to come out.
Yeah, I haven't even seen the first one.
Oh, like, my lord.
We're too busy making movies to watch them.
So even if it's a character like General Tarkin, they're going to have somebody doing motion capture for that, for all of his movements. If you've ever seen the pictures of actors with all the dots on their face,
those are motion capture.
Yeah, and those are called facial markers. So when an animator gets that like a camera shot of the actor, doing whatever with their face, so like say they're smiling or something, certain markers are going to be in different places, so that helps the animator essentially place things where they need to go when they're animating, so that they can match things up with the markers and whatnot. And so the toughest part is that you can motion capture somebody running and have it look exactly like somebody's running, but when you get to something as minute and as detailed as the face, when you have all these like little mannerisms that everybody has, which are unique, maybe a certain part of the face lifts up like a little bit, or, it's just like these really tiny things. It's super hard to capture when it comes to motion capture. So a lot of that animation is done, with less motion capture than you would like, because it's so difficult. So
is that why did Avatar work so well?
I think it's because they don't look
blue.
Like humans. Because
they're blue? Yeah. Is it because they're not super human? Like,
same thing with the second and third Pirates of the Caribbean, Davy Jones, who has like an octopus face. When I watched that movie, and it's not that new, I was like, that's the best CGI I have ever seen. Davy Jones looks 100% real.
Right.
But I think it's because it's not. I wonder if it's some primal level that we see something that's supposed to look human. It's supposed to be, something that we should recognize, but it's not quite there. And if it's just getting on some level, like Predator, dangerous, I don't like that.
I mean, think about it this way. So, When Avatar came out, I absolutely loved it. And the CG in that movie, the visuals in that movie are just astounding, and they're great.
Sure.
And so if you watch the movie Avatar, granted, they look like just really large humans with tails on their on their hair and on their behinds, but you've never seen a Na'vi before. So your brain goes like,
yeah, that's what
okay,
they look like.
This is new. This is what they look like. Oh, that's how they move. That's fine. So you're not as like acute or, zeroed in on them, acting exactly like humans.
Interesting.
So I have a quick question, and I don't know if you've ever done this kind of stuff, but like I get confused. I understand like motion capture for someone like Gollum or for Planet of the Apes, all the stuff that Andy Serkis does, basically. And all these like human characters or like kind of human-ish characters, or even if they're creatures, if they're basically they're bipedal, you know, stuff like that, I get it. I don't get like say take The Hobbit, right? Like Benedict Cumberbatch played Smaug, but he also did all the motion capture for Smaug. But Smaug's like a massive dragon. He's not human shaped at all. And so I've seen like videos of him and he's literally just like in a blue suit crawling around the ground being like, I'm Smaug. And I'm like, why?
Is it just like the hip thing
like,
to do?
And he was talking about like, it was so hard to like move like a dragon. And I'm just like, why did you? I don't get it.
Chris Pratt gets to wear like sweatpants for the Lego movie and just like sit there and be like, everything's awesome. And he's just like on the ground, like, feel the dragon soul.
So, and again, I don't know if you know, but like, what's the, why?
So I can't really,
I
can't really touch on why somebody is doing a full motion capture suit for a four-legged lizard.
It seems like it'd make it harder. Like,
I think he insisted on it and they just were like, I guess just tell him that we're recording it. We've already given us the shots together.
Yeah.
In a sense it would. But then if you look at those videos, he's got a camera on his face. So I think the main focus of that was his facial animations. Because if you take a look at, you know, a dragon, you know, they don't really smile like we do or anything like that. So a lot of the animation is actually focused on the eyes and it's focused on the corner of the lips and how they move their heads around, like what their little mannerisms are. So in order to fully get that character, you know, you're going to want to have some sort of motion capture that you can go back and forth just to get the mood of what's going on.
Okay.
Maybe to get his face in the mood, he had to slither around on the floor.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, maybe that's just his thing.
And I guess there's something to be gleaned, you know, the performance.
Yeah, I mean, I guess.
Matches the voice up and everything if he has a certain stock, you know, stalking way about him or something. But it's kind of funny. You're like, well,
because didn't they do that for the Jungle Book too? Didn't they do?
I think
like a little bit of motion capture for all the like Lupita Nyong'o and
I think for some of the actors
in the Jungle Book, and those are all animals.
Yeah, but I think you made a good point. I think and that this now makes sense to me is like it's mostly said for like the eyes and then like movement of like the head and stuff, because that's also my thing. It's like if whatever character they are doesn't have a human face, why would you track a human face? Like, again, like dragons don't smile like humans smile. But again, if you're like trying to go with like the eyes and stuff, that makes sense to me.
You're trying to get a performance like
that,
Rango,
that I get. Okay, that makes
sense. For Rango,
they
had
the point of this.
They filmed whole scenes and like Johnny Depp's in, you know, some of the costume stuff, and they're walking around and acting out the whole scenes, and they kind of filmed it and recorded the sound as reference for the artist to get an idea of how the scene would play out. So I guess it makes sense.
Well, they've done that for years in animation. I mean, Walt Disney, you can look at stills of like Cinderella and the actress who
there's
did that
scene,
the stepmother and everything like
that.
Yeah,
there's a scene from Alice in Wonderland where the tea party's being acted out with, you know, the actors that did the voices. So just anything to help an artist is, I guess, beneficial.
I guess, yeah. All right, cool.
So you've worked in movies. We've talked a lot about movies. Is there a difference between doing what you do in movies and then video games? Because video games, obviously, they're like all three, you know, CG and 3D, and it's like nobody's real in a video game. I learned in this podcast. Wow, Sims is alive.
Wowzers.
So is there a big difference there?
There is, especially for the field that I'm in. So I'm on the modeling and texturing side. So when I usually explain this to people, I like to say that video games and movies follow pretty much a parallel path up into a certain point, and then they just diverge into like all these different subtrees and whatnot.
Interesting.
And so, in a video game, the main difference between a video game and a movie when it comes down to like the technical aspect is that, with a movie, you're just watching it. So it can be as high res as you need it to be. As long as it plays on that movie theater screen, it's all good. A video game has to run off of your computer or your Xbox or your PlayStation or whatever. So it needs to be able to be small enough to fit within the computing power and parameters that system sets for you. So for a movie, I'll give you like a really basic like modeling kind of tutorial real quick. Cool. Like say you're making a cube, right? So a cube has six sides. So each side or each face of a 3D model is called a polygon. So any four sides is one poly. So, or yeah, 4 points, you know, that make up like a square is a poly. So when it comes to video games, one of the things that you have to look out for is your polygon limit on your entire scene or your character.
Oh, wow.
When you're playing a video game, the only thing that's rendering is what the camera is looking at. So as the camera, it's one way to save memory. So as the camera looks around, like you're rendering more and more.
What does that mean, rendering?
So say you're playing... say you're playing a video game where your character's just walking down a street and there's a bunch of buildings on the side. So whatever you see is essentially what the game engine is putting out for you to see. And if you were to pause everything and look around, like in real life, you wouldn't see anything other than what the camera's seeing. There would be nothing rendering.
It's just black. The world doesn't exist
pretty much
until you turn and look that way.
At least that's my understanding of it.
Sure.
And so as you move the camera around, it's rendering all this other stuff that's in the background and getting rid of all the other stuff it doesn't need to render because you want it to be able to run at its fullest capacity based on what it's doing. So there's a lot of little tricks and stuff that you can do in a video game studio to cut back on, you know, rendering times or how much information you can put on the screen at once. And one of those things is budgeting your polygon count. So in a movie, say you're creating, you know, a character or a creature that you want to be as detailed as possible, one of the things that you can do is just increase your polygon count so that you can see all the wrinkles and stuff in there, and you can have a really heavy, considered heavy based on the polygon count, a heavy character on the screen, because at the end of the day, you're going to send whatever shot you're working on to what's called a render farm, which is just like a server of computers that will just pump it out for you, and then that's it. Like, you don't have to throw it onto a game engine. It doesn't have to get rendered again. It just has to be thrown up on the screen.
Sure.
So you can essentially give yourself no limitations, but whereas a video game has to, you know, render out, you have to be really careful with what you're doing. So like say for a movie, you have a character's face that's like, I don't know, 100,000 polygons. Like, that's really high. If you go to a video game, maybe it's only 30,000 because you have to cut back
so much.
And so there's other things that you can do in a video game to still make it look as realistic as possible. So there are these things called, they're called normal maps in a video game. So essentially, say I had this desk here and I wanted to model that for a video game. Rather than modeling all the grooves of the wood in and everything, I would just use one polygon for the whole surface, so it'd be completely flat. And then I would take what's called a high poly model, which has all the grooves in it and everything that's the exact same size, and I would do what's called a bake. And I would take all the high res details and essentially throw it onto the low res mesh in what's called a normal map. And the normal map tells the light that hits the top of the polygon how to react. So if you're far away, it'll look like there's a bunch of grooves and all the details in there, but then if you get up close, it's just one flat plane.
No way!
Yeah, so
is so cool.
So the next time you're like playing, like if you go back to any old school video game and you look kind of like far away at a box or something, or like the side of a house that has a bunch of bricks on it, it'll look like the bricks are popping out and that they're, you know, been modeled into it. And then if you get your character right up next to it and just like kind of look sideways, it should be just like one flat plane.
That's so interesting. It's just little tricks.
Is that why, like, sometimes the YouTube, like, little teasers for video games maybe look better than, like, the game themselves? Because then they can spend more money and time on
the cutscenes.
You know, because I love watching those. I don't play that many video games, but I watch so many cutscenes for video games. Because they're, like, beautiful stories, and they're, like, they're beautifully done. And then the actual video game, not that it's bad at all, because, like, you know, I grew up on, like, crappy Bomberman and, you know, Star Fox. It's like, video games are incredible now, but it's not like quite as nice as the thing on YouTube.
It's because there's a limit, and so there's for, especially when you're marketing a game, you want it to, you know, look as nice as possible. So there's kind of, as far as what I see, there's like kind of two different schools of thought. You can either make what's called just a cinematic, which is a totally CG shot like you would normally see in a movie, but you're using, you know, 3D everything. It's fully CG, so there's no limit because you're just going to show it on a screen. Or you can use the in-game assets that you already have, like the characters and everything, if you want to show off how good the game is going to look compared to other predecessors or whatnot. So if you look at... recently, there was a trailer that came out for The Last of Us 2.
I watched that. I don't know anything about the game, but I watched that.
So
I do know a little bit about the game. I Wikipedia'd it. Okay, sorry.
So it's the people that are working on that are called, the studio's name is Naughty Dog, and they're actually working with another studio on a lot of the different like aspects of that trailer. So Naughty Dog provided like the characters and the assets and whatnot. And then they had all that stuff motion captured, but they transferred it into, you know, the in-game assets. So like when you see the girl, Ellie do this with her hands, like that's what it's going to look like in game. So they had somebody in the studio motion capturing that. And I heard that just that hand movement when she's playing the guitar and stretching it out took a long time, 'cause you got to get that stuff like right.
Wow.
But that's, from what I understand, most of that trailer is pretty much what it's going to look like.
Wow, that's cool.
So video games are now at this point where they're starting to move away from like limits like that, because there's so many different things that you can do now. Game engines are a lot more powerful. The hardware that you're playing them on is a lot more powerful. So you're going to start noticing that less and less as video games move forward.
That's going to be the key then, is that the software and the hardware has to get stronger and more powerful, because in terms of what you guys can do in on the artistic side and creating everything, that's already there with no limits.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, if you're running one way and you turn the camera, does the, you know, your console not explode? Yeah. It's like, nope. Too much stuff.
Exactly.
You know what else I don't want to limit on? Just a quick transition. I don't want to limit on the number of reviews that we're getting for this amazing episode on iTunes.
Good segue.
On whatever your podcast app is that you listen to, please take this time to rate us, review us, tell us what you like, what you don't like, topics you want to hear, so we can keep getting awesome guests like Aaron on the show to talk about their super cool jobs and all that goes into it.
Yeah.
So please leave us a review. You can do it while you're listening right now. Hopefully you started it 30 seconds ago. You're about to finish it when I'm done plugging this. So
yeah. iTunes can handle it, you guys. iTunes isn't like running off PS1 tech, man. It's fully modern.
The more ratings and reviews that we get, the more people will be able to find our show. And we think it's, you know, we want to keep giving you quality stuff to listen to, and we think it's worth hearing. So please rate and review us.
Yeah.
That was my awesome transition for the day.
So, beautiful.
Thank you.
Beautiful.
Cool. So okay. We talked a lot about video games, talked a lot about movies. You've worked on some super awesome movies, and we talked about Ant-Man, but are there any other movies that you've worked on? That you could you know just tell us some of the movies you've worked on before.
As far as visual effects go, I've only worked on 4 movies. I worked on The Age of Adeline.
I love Blake Lively. Oh my god! Sorry.
Work I did on that movie was there's a bunch of snowy scenes. I imagine, I haven't seen the movie, but there's a bunch of snowy scenes. So I made the quote unquote snowflakes for that. So a lot of that snow that's falling is CG. It's a super simple process.
Movies are bullshit, man.
Now that movie's ruined.
That was the first thing I did, the visual effects studio. So that's like the first movie I ever worked on was Age of Adeline.
Cool.
I worked on Ant-Man. I worked on Insurgent, and I worked on The Last Witch Hunter, with Vin Diesel. And that was actually a really fun project to work on, 'cause I made what's called Vin Diesel's I did a digital double. So essentially what that means is, say you have an actor like Vin Diesel, and he needs to perform some outrageous stunt where there's all these explosions going on or whatever. Probably don't want to have an actor or a human being doing that. So we'll create a digital version of that character or of that actor and throw that into the movie for the stunt, essentially.
Wow.
So what we do is we'll get the actors will get scanned. So they'll get their bodies scanned in costume, 3D scanned, and we'll get that raw scan data sent to us. And it's just a 3D version of them, and we build off of that. And so I've also worked on that side of pre-production for movies, scanning a bunch of actors. I've worked on a lot of TV stuff. Supergirl, American Horror Story,
Real Housewives of New Jersey,
Fear the Walking Dead.
You gotta animate those brows, baby.
Yeah.
I did a lot of work for Fast and the Furious, the new one that's coming out. I think it's Fast 8.
The Fate of the Furious?
The Fate of the Furious.
Yeah, man.
So cool.
So awesome.
That is so awesome.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question? With, like, you do, like, a digital double of Vin Diesel. Mm-hmm. Can you make his head, like, more round than it should be? Or do you guys ever, like, do goofy shit that, like, you guys would be like, ha ha ha? Because they've been doing that in Disney forever. There's just, like, some sort of, like, inappropriate joke, like, ee hee.
We don't normally do that with digital doubles because somebody's going to have to review them.
And he's just like, my biceps, they're this big.
But as far as, like putting funny stuff into movies, as a modeler and a texture artist, you actually get a lot of opportunities to do that.
Okay.
So nothing like, nothing super extravagant, but like, say for example, in Ant-Man, for that server room scene I was talking about, there's all these cords and cables coming out. And so we had to model those and texture those. And so part of the textures, that I did was I took the initials of the modeling and texturing people that I worked with at work and mine and our birthdays, and I put them on the cable.
Oh,
so there's
cool.
There's this scene where there's these ants crawling into the back of a computer, and you see a bunch of cords coming out, and there should be like AAC, which would have been my initials with like my birth date following it, and then some of the other people that I worked with, like their initials and stuff in
there.
That's
cool.
Awesome.
Yeah.
In Age Adeline, there's like one snowflake that's actually like a little guy flying. He's throwing up middle fingers.
Like, fuck you, Blake Lively.
No one's ever said that in the history of the world.
The hardest part of that movie is animating out her beard.
Full beard.
Have
Nick knows how much I love Blake Lively.
Oh, Ryan Reynolds is into it.
Well, damn, that's freaking.
That's freaking cool.
Nerds.
Yeah.
Man, any more questions, Casey?
I feel like
no.
Okay.
I feel like we're experts. I feel like I could render some polygons.
Yeah, man.
You know what I'm saying?
I'm my own render farm over here. No. I'm gonna render some polygons. I'm gonna texture and model some stuff. I'm gonna composite it. I'm gonna light it. You know what I mean? I do a bunch of stuff in the field. You guys, whatever you guys
normal
want.
Normal mapping.
That's snap.
Just throwing out
that's
words
crazy. But
that
since
we
okay,
learned.
Bake in the Uncouth Valley. What was it?
Uncanny Valley.
Sure.
Uncouth Valley.
Welcome to the Uncouth
really
Valley.
Uncouth
Valley.
Well, cool. Since we are experts, I think, Aaron, if you would indulge us, I think you need to test our knowledge, make sure we actually are experts. So I think it is time for our
quiz, pop quiz. It's time for the pop quiz. Quiz, pop quiz. We'll laugh when Nick loses.
Pop quiz!
Yeah, man. So okay. Do you have any...
I have two questions for you guys.
Two
okay.
I have two questions. So the first question is, what was the first use of CG in a movie? First ever use of CG in a movie.
I feel like this is one of the things that's going to be like way earlier than we
think. Or television. So film or TV, like on screen, when was the first use of CG?
Makes me think it's TV, guys.
I'm going to go Twilight Zone.
Wow.
Just going old school.
I'm going to go.
There's so much weird stuff in that show.
I'm going to go making stuff colorful for Wizard of Oz. I'm going way old because it could be color. I don't know.
Ooh, CG, though?
I don't know.
I'm thinking of something in the 80s. What would be a show in the 80s that would have CG?
Miami Vice.
I'm going to say the original Incredible Hulk TV show.
Oh, interesting.
Lou Ferrigno?
Yeah.
He was half that size.
So we have Twilight Zone, Wizard of Oz, and the Incredible Hulk. So you're all wrong.
Woo!
Damn it.
The first year, according to my knowledge and not my handheld computer device. Yep. The first year CG was used in any sort of movie or film was in 1961.
Wow.
Okay, so Nick's closest in the year. Yeah.
It's on this film called Rendering of a Planned Highway.
They were rendering that movie polygons?
Exactly.
Yeah. You could so only much. Do three polygons.
Does it take place
time,
in the Uncouth Valley?
No. Nothing does.
Nothing.
1960, a 49-second vector animation of a car traveling down a planned highway was created at the Swedish Royal Institute of Technology on the BESK computer.
That was my next guess, actually.
I should have known. You just upgraded from that recently.
Okay, wow. So we're all at zero.
Fantastic.
Okay, I'd love to see that because I'm so curious, you know. You go back and watch like clips from the first Tron, and you're like, ooh. At the time, they were like, oh my god, do you see this? Okay, so
all right,
cars on highways.
So this question, if you get like within the ballpark, I think you should get it right.
Yeah, yeah.
So, how many? What was the total number of unique Lego bricks used in the Lego Movie?
What do you mean unique?
Unique. So like. Just
individual.
Know, individual.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God. Nick, you guess first, because you never guess first.
Do you guys want to talk about it a little bit before, in case, so that you guys can maybe form your ideas around the idea of the Lego Movie? Because it's actually an amazing piece of visual effects work, and I love it.
It really
Ooh,
is.
Yeah.
It's like stop motion, but not... I love it.
So they...
Genius.
Everything in that movie, pretty much, is CG. So when they were creating the scenes for that movie, the studios or the modelers were given, like, 3D Legos, and they built them. Like, that's what you would normally build on a computer.
We watched, like, half of that movie the other day, and that's what I was thinking. I was like, they probably just built stuff with... virtual Legos.
That's
and they
exactly
did?
What they did.
Oh my God.
Like, so cool.
That must have been so much fun.
The people I saw that movie with were just like, yeah, it was a fun movie. And I was like, that was amazing.
Yeah.
Like,
seriously. It's so cool. It's so cool. Okay.
All right. Well, then I'm going 2,496,023,814.2 Lego bricks.
I'm going to say lower, but I'm probably too low. I'm going to go 42 million bricks.
I'm going to go. no, you know what? I think it's. I want to go between 2 billion and 40 million. Let's say.
It's a small gap.
Let's say 350 million.
Okay. Mike was closest.
That's what's really? Up.
There were a total of 3.8 million unique Lego bricks in the movie.
That's it. Wow.
According to the film's production notes, many of those bricks were reused to create a lot of the scenes. However, if you wanted to create the entire movie, you would need 15,080,000 Lego pieces.
Well, that's still way less than I was expecting.
Wow. Yeah, but I mean,
but it's still crazy
15,
to think about.
So yeah.
15
cool, though,
million. Like, I mean, throwback to the New Hampshire episode, you saw the biggest Lego sculpture, and there was not 15 million Legos.
There's three, though.
Yeah, but times five.
That's true.
Wow. Imagine that.
That's amazing.
That's pretty nuts.
Wow.
I would like to think it was a fun project.
Mike wins with like a half a point.
I'll take it.
Yeah.
Victor of the week. Aaron, man, that thank you so much. That was the
thank you so much.
No, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for coming on. If anybody's interested in learning more about Aaron's art, you can go to his website at www.achayesart.com. His name is Aaron Coleman Hayes. You can also just Google his name, Aaron. Spelled like a normal way you'd spell Aaron.
A-A-Ron.
Not the girl spell A-A-Ron. Coleman, C-O-L-M-A-N dash Hayes, H-A-Y-E-S. And you can Google him, see his IMDb page. So we highly recommend it. We're going to link it, of course. But, you know,
we'll be posting some of your art. This dude is supremely talented. Yeah. We're not messing around. There's a reason he's here.
Inside.
Yeah. Okay, so you guys are going to see his art one way or another, because we're going to put it in your face.
Yeah.
In a nice way.
We can't wait to start showing you.
Yeah, Aaron, dude, that was so cool. Nick, you said, this is why movies cost so much money.
This is why movies cost so much money.
So much that goes on to it. And that's just stuff that happens after you filmed the movie.
Right.
Holy balls.
I mean, it's just such a cool, you know, you said, like, it's a underappreciated art.
100%.
You know, I mean, it's the second most underappreciated art, the first being Aaron's eyes.
Oh yeah. Oh, and there will be links to that somehow.
All we're linking.
We just want to embarrass Aaron as much as possible.
People on the
planet.
And so Aaron,
you can find a Twitter account for Aaron's eyes that we're going to make. It's called Aaron's eyes.
You'll
just know what that means.
The only friend of the Twitter account is going to be Oval Face Elite.
By the way, good point. Good plug. Oval Face Elite is my Twitter handle. Aaron, I don't know if you know, but back a while ago, I was told that I have a perfect face, and so I started to share that with the world. So Oval Face Elite at Twitter, please, you know, follow and participate in the conversation. If you also have an oval face, you have an ideal face shape. If you don't, please, you can spectate, but please don't participate.
Just imagine what would happen if we combined your face with my eyes.
Dude, I can't fathom how the world would react. Dude, how the galaxy would react.
You could also find us on other social media at The Brothers Murph. You can look us up on any channel that you like. We're there. We'd love to talk. Rate us, review us on iTunes, you know, the huge. Go on our Patreon, donate if you want. And
just keep listening, though, one way or another.
That's the main thing.
Listen,
we love you all. Yeah. 2017, we're excited for the rest of the year.
Yeah, it's going to be great. And we have some fun stuff coming up in the next couple of weeks, which we'll let you guys know about. So do stay tuned for that. And I guess for now, I have been Mike J. Murphy.
I'm Nick Murphy.
Casey Brown.
Our guest has been
Aaron Coleman.
Yeah, it is. And we are imploring you, as always, to stay curious.
He had the most beautiful eyes.